So it's a bit of home territory. I'm in Ben Keefe's office in London. And we're going to talk about Ben's career for a change and put it on the Star Sports website. So Ben, can you tell us from the very beginning, please, when you first became aware and interested in betting?
Well, when I was a child, I never would have watched horse racing or even thought about having a bet. And at the age of 12, I remember my dad coming into the kitchen and say, come to the dogs with me. My dad was a solicitor in Worthing, and I grew up in a village called Hurstpier Point. And my mum was supposed to go with him. It was a work function, or I don't know what it was, some sort of like work social thing. And my mum didn't want to go. She said, go on out from under my feet, you go to the dogs. I said, dog racing? I don't want to go dog racing. I would have no interest in dog racing. I went to the dogs. I remember we were sitting in the restaurant above the bookies, and I had a £2 place bet on a dog called Sarah Jones. I think it was an A11 or an A12, first race of the night. Anyway, I don't know if she won or placed, but the bet won. It was a £2 bet on the tote. And that was it. I was, you know, the excitement of the betting ring, the lights over the track at night. I think that's always quite intoxicating. You know, the dogs. I mean, I love dogs as animals as well. I love to watch a greyhound run. I like to watch a greyhound have a hand slip or a trial. And I just fell in love with the game then. But the betting ring is what really attracted me. I loved watching tic-tac. I used to make notes of different tic-tac, racing language, fractions. I learned how to clerk as a child. I was the school bookie. I did work experience with lots of different bookies. The first bookmaker I did work experience with was Beau Brown of West End Racing. And my dad said to me before I went out the door that day, I remember going out the back door and I was walking up to Hassock Station and I was shadow clerking, which means I was standing next to the clerk and practicing clerking. I would have been about 13. And my dad said, you're going to work for lots of different bookies and see lots of different bookies work. Keep the good, leave the bad. And I always remember that. And other bookmakers who were kind to me were Neil Channing. When he used to bet on course with Steve Todd, I did work experience with him. Martin Johnston, later in my teens, when I was, say, 17, 18, Martin would have been my first mentor of gem racing. You know, an incredibly professional, professional gambler, a real Rolls-Royce of a bookmaker, a figures man, and a gentleman. I would say that Martin was... He sort of taught me the way to be respectful, be smart. He always deals with clients well. I watched him work when I was that age, and I picked up, I'd like to think, good things. But something I learned from Beau Brown, Neil Channing, and Martin Johnston was that they wanted to enable, they wanted to educate, they wanted to give others a chance. And when I look at the game now, it's very hard for on-course bookmakers to get into the game. The back row pitches aren't worth anything. It, you know, opening an independent betting shop now is going to cost a lot of money and it's a big gamble. It's hard for young people to get into the game. And I never forget what the work experience I was given as a teenager at City Index Sports, obviously, too. There was a Cohen, the on-course bookmaker. He gave me work experience with Bubbles. God rest his soul. He used to be his helper. And Bubbles used to get me into Plumpton or Brighton for free. And I used to go and watch and help. And it was great fun. And I'm very, very grateful to those people. And I would say that's something I've carried on, which is wherever possible, giving young people a chance in the game.
Okay, Ben, you obviously did your apprenticeship with the bookmakers, but was punting ever a serious part of your early career?
Yes, definitely career. I mean, look, when I was a kid, I used to go to the dogs. I loved going to the dogs. Every day at school, I would get, before I went to school, I would get the Sporting Life and the Racing Post. I was the school bookie. And all the teachers, all the boys of all ages used to come to me at break time and bet. I used to bet on the, you know, sporting events. and I used to bet on school events, say like the first team and the rugby or the cross country, things like that, next head boy, all good betting events. And even at that age, I think I learned the value of information, because a couple of years I had someone come and whisper the name of the next head boy to me. So I was able to adjust my prices, should I say. But it was a fantastic start. I mean, look, I used to wash cars every Sunday. It was off school. I'd go and wash cars. I'd get my hands on a tenner. I'd have enough money from taking the bets at school, being the school bookie, to buy my Sporting Life, buy my Racing Post. I used to read Pat Kelly's column in the Evening Argus. He's a very good judge, and that's a great column the Evening Argus do for Hove Dogs. And yeah, I used to study the form. And Lofty, Martin Chapman, who works for Star Sports to this day, he would have been my first punting teacher. He's a good judge of dog racing, a good judge of price also, that, you know, there's two different things. I used to see Lofty at Portsmouth when they had open racing there. I used to see Lofty at Hove Dogs when he used to work for Bo Brown. We'd go through the card together. I'd dig out a few. Look, at a young age, I got involved in silly things. I remember once I went to the dogs and Chris Eubank was fighting that night, and I had a maximum bet in the last race, and I didn't want to have no discipline and lose all the money beforehand. And I had a tenner at 1-10 in the back house betting shop there, thinking, right, I'll have 11 quid at the end of the night. This, he can't get beat, Eubank, and I'm going to put it all on my maximum bet anyway. You know the score. Eubank didn't win. I think he drew or something like that. I lost my tenner, and of course the dog in the last race won. But I did work experience at City Index, and I started work with them a week after I finished my A-levels. My first boss there was a man called Paul Austin, who's a lovely man. Really nice guy. I'd love to know what Paul Austin is doing now. I'd love to meet up with him. He was such a good guy. And then I, one day out of the blue, Kelvin Richardson, who was a client of City Index, and I'd met him at the dogs, a real character, he said to me, look, there's this guy, he's a good judge on the football, he's working for Victor Chandler, he wants to set up a spread betting firm for Victor Chandler. I said, interesting, what's his name? He said, his name's Tony Bloom. And I said, oh right, okay, I don't think I'd met this guy or heard of this guy. And a week later, I was in Richards, which was a very nice restaurant then in Hove, and I had a brief lunch. I was 19 years of age with Tony, and he said, well, do you want the job? I said, yeah, I'd love to come. Oh, another week later, I was on a plane on the way to Gibraltar, and I was there for 6 months, and for whatever reason, they couldn't get the spread betting going. There was a problem with the license or something like that, some silly licensing problem. And one day the seniors who worked upstairs in the racing room came down. They said, we've been out last night with someone associated, it was the trainer or the owner of a horse called Pension Fund. And that they all got pissed, and the owner or the trainer said, look, this is going to be 33-1 tomorrow. This should be favourite, and we think it's going to win. I backed it at 33s and 25s to win 10 grand. It went off, I think, about 6-1, and it won. And we were all on it in the office. And I went into work the next day, and I said to Tony, I said, look, thanks a lot. You're betting on these Asian handicaps. I don't know if I really think that's going to last. I'm going to go and become a bookie. It's my dream. So I went off with my 10 grand and obviously did my very best to knock that out quickly, you know, betting on cricket runs and doing other silly things like that that I did in my 20s when I was pissed. And yeah, that's where it all started. But what an error that was. I thought Asian handicap betting wasn't going to last. What a fool. Yeah, that was that wasn't my finest hour. But look, you've got to live with your decisions.
Many people might think that Star Sports has had a fairly meteoric rise. You've sort of burst into the public sort of view in the last few years. So what that when did all this start? When did you first stand up as Star Sports?
When did I first bet as Star Sports? Well, when I came back at 20, I worked with a man called Barry Slaney. He was a bookmaker who was retired. He had a few pitches left. And I wasn't old enough to be a bookie. I had to be 21. So I used to stand next to Barry and he used to take a few bets. That was in the days when the rails bookies didn't have boards. They just sort of put a flap with their name over the rail and they'd shout out a horse they wanted to lay. And then I got a betting shop, I think I would have been 21, 22, in Sutton Common Road in Sutton, and I bet under the name of Star Racing for the first time. That was a baptism of fire. I mean, the staff were crooked off the scale. They were waiting for me, and I learnt a lot there. But the next step would have been, I bet, Roger Cairns, who owns Sittingbourne Central Park, he gave me a pitch there, and that was, I would say, my first break. The first time I got some profile, I would have been, 24, 25, something like that, betting at Sittingbourne, and that was a cracking pitch. The nicest people I've met in greyhound racing were at Sittingbourne. The nicest ring I've worked in was at Sittingbourne, and I always used to win there. Every Sunday night I'd go there. I didn't take colossal money. We used to go there. We used to take 20 grand, but we used to work together, the bookies, getting the prices right, not trying to knife each other like it's been. I've seen at other dog tracks. They the bookies, John Wilson, Steve Warner, they were nice guys, and John's daughter Jo, we all used to work together to get the prices right. I used to take about 20 grand, but I took it sweetly. I laid lots of dogs and I was winning and winning and winning there. And then I moved to get the pitch at Walthamstow, and I think I would have been about 25, 26 then. And that's when I got a lot more profile. So that would have been about 12 years ago. And then whilst I was at Walthamstow, was doing a lot of my own punting. I was winning punting, but the grass was greener, I thought, and I looked at my heroes in betting, say like Tony Morris and John Humphreys and all these other bookies who'd done well. They'd all got shops, and I bought myself half a dozen betting shops and took my eye off the punting. I thought, no, the way forward is to open a chain of betting shops. At the time, firms like Mervyn Wilson and Jack Brown were getting shops, selling them, making a fortune. Anyway, I bought them at just the wrong time. The value of shops went down. That was a terrible error. I mean, that took me close. I nearly went under then. Whilst I was at Walthamstow, I opened a credit office above a betting shop. At the back of a betting shop we had in Patcham. I started taking phone bets. Then when I sold the shops, I sold a couple for a few quid, which was good, and I closed a couple. But we had a betting shop in Goring in Worthing. There was a credit office, a flat above there. We wired the SIS from the shop to the office upstairs. I don't know who did that for us. I don't think we ever paid a penny rent on the flat because Betfred had the shop. They said, they bought the shop off me. They said, yeah, we'll sort that rent out. And we were there for years and they never called us. They were a pleasure to deal with, Betfred. I must say, we sold them a couple of shops. They were gentlemen to deal with. So we were there for a long time. And whilst I was there, I got my first big punter. He was a landowner in the West Country, big, big punter, and I caught him at the wrong time. I was laying in big. I learned then I hedged a bit of it, which was an error, just a little bit. I didn't get paid by the punter. It was 600 grand, and I was absolutely on my arse. Then I had to sell my house to get the equity out of the house to keep the business going. And I'd say that when I got to about 30 is when it sort of just started to level off a bit, and I learned to be a bit more patient, and I learned to let the business come to me.
Ben, you mentioned your first big punter. Now, you're well known in the UK for laying some colossal bets, including some eye-watering amounts at Cheltenham last year. But what a lot of people may not know is that Star Sports lay those sorts of bets week in, week out. How do you sleep at night?
Well, look, I would love to have a business like Bet365 or William Hill or whatever, where there's people having fivers on all day and they're betting on a casino and they win every day. But, you know, at this stage of my career, I can't compete with them. I can't have, you know, extremely powerful websites with betting through the night and you know, huge chains of betting shops and whatever else. So the way I compete is I take the bets off the big punters. I mean, it doesn't really make much of a difference whether it's Royal Ascot or Cheltenham. I mean, you know, something that's 6-4 at Royal Ascot, it's got the same chance as winning as something that's 6-4 at Ludlow. But we have a lot of big punters, and it's not really, you know, we don't take opinions, we play the punter, so we, you know, we bet to figures and we bet to faces. We're not betting to opinions. But look, I'm happy to play big at the big meetings because, you know, it's a very, very solid market. You can see a horse, it's been 2-1 all morning, it's been 9-4 for the last 3 months. Suddenly they contract these favourites as they normally do at Cheltenham and Ascot. You can lay 6-4. I don't think I'm going to do much wrong. And yeah, of course, look, when I'm having a bad run, I toss and turn all night. I've been taking sleeping pills since I'm 38. I think I've been taking sleeping pills for 20 years, nearly 20 years, tossing and turning all night. When there's a bad run, I think, when's it going to end? When's it going to end? All the last minute goals are going in, all the short heads are going in. But when you are a bookmaker on the track and you're standing on the pitch, you've got to say, who do you want to be? You've got to make yourself the person you want to be. You're not going to just be that person. And that first time when you're standing on the pitch and a punter comes up to you and they say 2 grand at 5-2 and they're going in the traps or they're going in the stalls or whatever, you've got to say to yourself, look, do I want to be Victor Chandler, Barry Dennis, Tony Morris, whoever, right? Or do I want to lay the guy a 10-4, knock him back, and then he doesn't bet with me again, and I'm just, you know, fiddling about? Look, everyone's got to do what suits them, but I think that the everything in your body says, don't lay this big bet, don't lay this big bet, this is dangerous to you. And then there's a voice that says, if you want to be Tony Morris, you've got to lay that bet. And then you say 5,002, ticket 82, and you've laid the bet. And you turn, you watch the race, it's like an out-of-body experience, you can't believe what you've done. Please God, the dog gets beat, and guess what, that's your new level. Then you'll lay it, then the next, someone comes in, then for a grand at fives, or a 5 grand at evens, you've done it before, you're in the swing of it, and off you go. If you say no, you probably won't lay a bet that big again, because it's like falling off a horse and not getting back on. I think it's being a bookmaker is much more about what you've got here and self-belief that you're laying the right clients at the right price than about being financial. I think people confuse that. They very much confuse that. It's much more of a, being a bookmaker is much more of a mental than financial exercise.
So are there punters that you've had to wave the white flag at in the end, regardless of prices?
Absolutely. Look, on our spread betting a few years ago, we had a punter, he won over £2 million. And I fancied that I beat him, and I did. He knocked it out, and he's knocked a bit more out. Certainly not what he was up, but the figures looked after me then, and I bet to figures, and I thought, I'm going to beat this guy. I kept laying him, and he knocked the money out. But of course, there are big punters. I mean, at the moment, we've got a big odds on punter. He bets odds on, you know, he just bets 10 on, 12 on, cricket, darts, football, under 3.5 goals, 8-1 on, or whatever. He had a long winning run. He went about 850 grand clear. He's come south. He's probably 350 grand clear now. I think I'll beat him, but I've had other punters who've well beaten me, and I've thought there's something not right here. And I think that, look, I've had the benefit of a lot of good advice over the years, and old friend of mine, Mitchell, he said to me once, he a streetwise guy, he said to me at Walthamstow, he said, if ever you have a funny feeling about someone or a situation, it will prove to be right. And if I have a funny feeling, I listen to it now.
People always like to hear about absolute catastrophes as far as bookmakers go. What can you remember your worst ever week or day or bet?
Well, we had our worst ever week 2 weeks ago. And we have a big punter betting on football. And he was just about to pay his account. He was going to pay £1 million. And which is a big, big payment. And you know, we'd caught him right. We'd beaten him on the sort of December football. And it was all agreed to pay £1 million, and I spoke to the guy on the Friday, and then we had the I spoke to him on, before the Friday, maybe on the Wednesday. Then we literally had the worst 5 days ever, and on the spread betting and on the fixed odds, he won £1.5 million. So he went from being down over £1 million to being up. That wasn't much fun. So, you know, you haven't got paid till it's in the bank and it's cleared.
Well, as an employee, that's a little bit too frightening to listen to. So can you tell us about the best day or week?
Do you know something? I can't really. I mean, not because I'm trying to be evasive or anything, but I don't remember results. I never remember the names of horses. I never remember races. I never remember football matches. I mean, I remember we had a very bad football match on the spread betting to the big punter who went £2 million clear a few years ago. He won 450 grand on one match. He backed the corners, the shirt numbers, the bookings, all high. But he bought them all, and they all went crazy. There were lots of goals and sendings off and corners. But the best, look, there's been some great days at Cheltenham. I mean, someone once had 750 grand on a in-running football bet at 1-12. That got beat. Saying that, he'd had lots of other similar bets at those types of prices that had won. But it's not really about that. It's about keep going. The game is about whether you're a punter, you're a bookie, you're a trainer, you're a track promoter, whatever you do, it's about survival. It's about keep going. Let's have another go tomorrow. It's not about thinking about the best day or the worst day. Just keep going.
You've been quite outspoken on Twitter occasionally about both punters and staff. Is it tongue-in-cheek, or do you really mean it sometimes?
I think that we work in a game where people scream blue murder to their entitlements and their rights, whether they be a punter, a bookie, or a member of staff, and then once they've got their own way or that moment's passed, they then want to behave deplorably to someone else, and that's fine. I think that in my time in the game, I've always seen when punters work together, often with bookmakers, both parties do well. When bookmakers work together at the races, or even if they own shops in a similar area or whatever, they do better. But we do seem to live and work in a game, particularly where people will say whatever it takes to get to break through, to get that clever business on, to get credit, or whatever, they will then take shocking liberties, walk away feeling very smug and telling everyone how clever they think they've been, and then scream blue murder when someone doesn't roll over next time and let them get away with what they wanted to get away with. I would say that certainly as a bookmaker and a business owner, I've had rather a lot of punters and staff test my patience.
What is the best part about being a bookmaker and running a firm as big as Star Sports, and the worst?
Look, I think that there's wonderful camaraderie as a bookmaker when you go away to Cheltenham or you go to Royal Ascot, and you're with the guys and you're enjoying it and everybody's working well, the whole business, whether it be punting or bookmaking, you know, the shop at the track, the fixed odds, the pitches, it's working like a Rolls Royce, the pistons, it's all, you know, going round and everything's really, really at full pelt, but the business is working to its full potential. That's a great feeling to know that right across the business, you're really, really busy and you're doing what your whole year is dedicated to do. Of course, you know, if you go to the races and there's a couple of short ones on the card and you get them both beat, it's a great feeling and you've had a great day and on you go for the next day, always at Cheltenham and Ascot. We always seem to lose on the Tuesday, the first day. Those seem to be the punters' cars and it's about winning it back. We always seem to win on the Friday and Saturday of Royal Ascot and Gold Cup Day to get out of it and win when we do win. And I think another nice thing, it is enabling people. It's nice to see, you know, a young lad out of school, 17, 18, 19 years of age, wants to attack the game, hungry, keen, wants to learn, wants to get stuck in, wants to go that extra yard every day to learn his percentages, to learn his figures, to learn how to clerk, to learn how the book is made up, to learn how to deal with clients, wants to look smart, wants to have the pitch looking smart, and wants to be part of the engine and push his bit as hard as he can. It's a great thing to really be able to enable a young person who wants to enter the game.
So you've already said quite rightly that there are a lot of obstacles for anybody that wants to try and emulate, for example, what you did. What would your advice be to anybody now that was determined as you were to become a successful bookmaker from scratch?
I think that people so often want to put up their own barriers and say, oh, I can't do it, I can't do it. And then when they see someone do it, they can be very jealous and nasty because you've proven them wrong. Not that you've tried to prove them wrong, but they've been proven wrong. And really, they've realised it wasn't about money. It was about strength of character, time and patience and pushing to make it work. I really, really would say to anybody who wants to be a bookmaker, it's not about money. It's about, are they prepared to start that long, long journey of buying some, you know, winning a few quid punting, working hard on their punting, grafting out a profit with that money, buying a pitch or two. They're going to buy a good pitch, then they're going to buy a bad pitch. I would always say to someone, you're best off having one cracking pitch instead of five okay ones. You're best off having one really good shop in the right position than four mediocres where there's nothing that good there. The main thing I would say, though, is work with other people. you will meet so many people in the game. The game, you can't really say you're a bookmaker now. It's a bit like being a lawyer. 20 years ago, people used to say, I'm going to go and see the lawyer. But now, the law is so vast. It's like the game is so vast. Now you have bingo, online bingo halls. You've got online betting, shops, credit betting, apps. You've got in running. You've got price providing companies. You've got people who provide websites and platforms for bookmakers. You've got compliance. That they're betting all over the globe now. The game is vast. Make lots of contacts, be nice to people, work with people, do people good turns, and things will come your way, opportunities will come your way, and the game will open up. If you give to the game, I'm always convinced the game will give back to you. And I would, if I said any other advice to a bookmaker, it would be patient, let punters come to you. When it's right, you'll be busy. When it's not right, don't try and be busy, because you'll give away prices or concessions, or you'll run after the wrong punters. Whenever I've not been busy is when I've really got myself in trouble. I've done it to myself. I've chased after punters who've then absolutely battered me, or I've pulled prices on a track to try and lay a horse, and I've laid over the price I should lay. Let the business come to you. When it's right, you'll do business. If you're nice and smart, and you're offering decent prices, you'll take money.
Ben, last year, you achieved one of your ambitions, sponsoring the Greyhound Derby. Obviously, it means a lot to you, but tell us just how much.
Well, when I was a kid, I used to say to Lofty, Martin Chapman, who was, he used to clerk for Bo Brown at Hove Dogs, and he was one of my first teachers of, you know, how the book worked and how clerking worked, and he was a good judge. He'd teach me a lot about dog racing and pricing a race up, doing the order of the race first and, you know, pricing it up. And I always used to say to Lofty, one day, we're going to be a bookmaker in the front line at Cheltenham, and we're going to bet at the Greyhound Derby. And well, we did both, and we also sponsored the Greyhound Derby. And look, I'm delighted to have been able to give back something to a sport that has given me so many friends, so many happy memories. And I think that in my life, you know, I've had a lot of ups and downs. Look, you know, you make friends, you lose friends. It's a tough game. But dog racing has been a real passion of mine. I love just to go to the dogs socially and have a bite to eat. I wouldn't go to horse racing socially or for a day out. It doesn't do it for me, but I love to watch a dog run. I love the atmosphere at the dogs. And I feel very, very, very lucky.
And how do you feel as Towcester as a venue?
I think that the effort that the management team put in at Towcester is absolutely fantastic. I think Lord Hesketh is, you know, he's such a dapper, charismatic, driven leader. Kevin Ackerman and Mick Livesey, I think that they'd crawl over nails for Lord H. The track gleams. The restaurant is excellent. The service in the restaurant is superb. There's Mayfair service. I mean, that track at night, when it gets dark and it's lit up, it looks superb. Look, you've got to get used to it. When you go there, yeah, it is further away. Yes, it's not, it hasn't got that Romford atmosphere where you're locked in over the track. But they do it so well there. And really, for the first attempt for the 2017 Derby, I mean, to get 5,500 people in year one, it was just exceptional. And I believe that the Greyhound Derby will become an event like, say, the boat race or, you know, the British Grand Prix or the British Open or, you know, the snooker at the Crucible, the FA Cup final. It'll be a Royal Ascot. It'll be something that people go to who aren't necessarily hugely interested in dog racing, but it's such a flagship night, like, say, Ladies' Day at Royal Ascot or the Cup final or whatever, or the boat race, that they go to that. Because they go to the Greyhound Derby final, because it's a great show, and that's where the sport gives of its best, and the bookmakers at the track, the trainers, the hospitality staff, and particularly the management team, all come together at Toaster to make a brilliant derby, and I cannot wait for this year.
So that's a very positive look on what's happened. But there's been a very sad decline, especially in the metropolitan tracks in recent years. Do you put that down solely to the value of the real estate that they used to sit on? Or is there something else that's happened?
Well, I think that it's the value of the real estate, the land, that has made the other things happen. I mean, you know, Let's think about other areas of the game. If you go into, say, a Coral's betting shop, I always think they fit their betting shops beautifully. I think that some betting shops on the high street, they are definitely the best shops of any type of industry on the high street. Look at what they spend on the fit. It's exceptional. You know, you go to a box at Royal Ascot. You know, there's art on the walls. The viewing is superb. They've spent millions of pounds on the design. Same for bingo halls. These are big businesses. You go to a lot of dog tracks, particularly at ones that have been owned by the GRA. Well, the land's worth a lot of money. It suits them to run it down. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing to say. Wimbledon, as a, you know, properly bought up to standard, like, say, a Toaster, if you put Toaster where Wimbledon Dog Track was, they would have had 5,000 people there every night. People from all over the world, when they came to London, Wimbledon Dogs on a Saturday night was full of tourists who wanted to have a night at the dogs. But if you went into the toilets, they were like First World War latrines, and it was very, very sad that the owners of the track let it go that way. But it suited them to run it down, say to everybody they couldn't make it pay, and then sell these places to build lots of very small and overpriced flats. I think that Betfair have not helped the game at Walthamstow. When Betfair came in, I did my very best to make sure that Betfair was banned in the ring. It was banned. The Chandlers listened. This was when the racing was on TV. Everybody at the track said, when the racing was on TV, this is fantastic, we can stay at home and play on Betfair. And a few people looked at this and said, well, the track's going to close then. 18 months later, track closes. I think that punters of you know, that in the early days of Betfair, they believed all the punters pal waffle. They fell for that. They wanted to fall for it. They liked Betfair, so they've been part of that. They've helped it happen, and tracks have suffered because people are playing on the machine at home instead of going to the track, using the bookmaker, spending money in the bar and supporting the game. And you can only take so much before there's nothing left. And sadly, that's what's happened. And you look at Betfair, the punters fell. They fell for all of Betfair. We like punters who win, winners welcome, all of that utter rubbish. Now they're paying premium charge, they're paying more commission than they used to. And half the dog tracks are closed. So, very sad, and Betfair don't pay any levy to the game. So there we go. But the punters, they must have wanted it to happen because they let it happen and they supported it.
One of the sad things, extra sad things about what's happened, is the now dearth of characters that used to be at dog tracks? You must have some special memories of some special characters back in the day.
Do you know something? Look, there's some things to agree with there, but there's some things not to agree with. I think that people talk about the good old days. They talk about when the game was good. Look, the game hasn't died. The game has moved on. Bookmakers used to take fortunes in the betting ring, fortunes on the rails, particularly, say, in the 9p days. And now, look, there's much more money being gambled than there ever was then, but it's online and people are betting on apps and all the rest of it. Sadly, the game has moved away from the betting ring and independent bookmakers who, as I said earlier, I love the camaraderie of the ring. I like to always be talking and socialising with other independent bookmakers. And it's very, very sad. But look, I don't think we should always be talking about the good old days and weren't there so many characters. If you go to Royal Ascot and Cheltenham now, it gets busier every year. If you're smart, if you've got a pitch in a half-decent position, you will take fantastic money at Cheltenham and Royal Ascot, and you will still meet and do business with some great punters and you'll work alongside some really, really professional and impressive bookmakers. So never mind the good old days. Let's make some happy memories.
As well as being a well-known and well-respected bookmaker, you're also a well-known gastronome. Your vlogs get four-figure views on a regular basis. When did the passion for culinary delight start?
Well, I'll tell you why I do it. One of the reasons I started doing it is because when the racing used to be on Channel 4, they used to come up 10 minutes before and they'd say, right, we're going to come up to you in 10 minutes and we're going to say, right, okay, Fourheen's running, it's even money, what have you laid of Fourheen? And what big bets have you taken and what's your lay of the day? So you could be all ready for that and then they'd come over and you'd say your bit. Now, on ITV, you're working away, busy, busy, busy. As I said, it's busier and busier at Royal Ascot and Cheltenham every year. And suddenly, Matt Chapman's there with the microphone in your face and asking you a question. Now, I started doing my food vlogs because Belinda would hold up the camera and at first I'd say, oh no, I'm not ready. Oh, hang on, there's some people looking, or I need to think about what I'm going to say. And now she holds up the camera, she says 3, 2, 1, and I do my vlog. And it gives me practice, so when they come up, if it's a TV or radio person or whatever, and they put the microphone straight in my face, I'm ready to talk. I just do it, and I feel relaxed. But anyway, it's good fun. I love eating out. I love going to new places. And look, I go out 3 nights a week for work. So I go out with people that I'm doing business with. It's fun to talk to them, fun to go to their favourite restaurants or take them to my favourite restaurants to try new places, whether it be Pie and Mash or a Fiver or somewhere fancy in Mayfair. It's a bit of fun, it's a hobby, and why not?
Have you had any negative feedback from any of the restaurants you've been less than complimentary about?
No, I haven't, but I've had nice feedback from ones that I've been nice about. I don't like to criticise restaurants I go to because I am going to independent restaurants that are family owned. I mean, look, of course, there's going to be the odd shocker, but on the whole, I try to get a bit of a card before I go out and get my card marked from a few shrewdies as to where I should be eating.
Here we are, Ben. Is there anything that you think could happen in the game that would push it further and sort of help everybody along?
I think that when I look at horse racing and dog racing, although they're our life, we live in these sports, and to us they're enormous, they're actually very, very small. And I actually think they're a bit too democratic. I think that horse racing and dog racing, they need a Barry Hearn or a Bernie Eccleston who says, right, I own the franchise of dog racing, of horse racing. I've listened to everybody. I've called all stakeholders to come to a meeting, and this is how it's working. I think Nick Rust has shown a lot of flair as the top man at the BHA. You know, he smacked the firm's arses last year. He's got them paying levy on their horse racing business that they're taking abroad, and what he's done is fantastic. They spat venom at him, but he stood his ground and he got that done, and I believe that he should be forever respected and appreciated for standing his ground there and being strong with the firms. I'd like to see him given more power to make decisions like that, to get things done. But I think that for me, as a bookmaker, I would like to see more young bookmakers. It's not healthy that so many of these big firms are merging. So they're not three firms, they're one firm. It's less flair that they need to show to get business. It's less competition. They're sort of faceless corporate outfits who don't really think about bookmaking. All their thing, you know, they're IT companies, they're technology companies who are running enormous affiliate schemes to get clients in. That's fine, but I would like to see more young people trying to become bookmakers, and I would like to see at the racecourse, when you see satellite rings, they call them. So when you go to Royal Ascot and you see five bookmakers by the bandstand or by the parade ring or round the back in the members area or whatever, I'd like to see when these areas open up, possibly them given to, you know, five bookmakers. Right, we would like to see five bookmakers who are under the age of 25 go there, and they might even have their pitch there, and they might have a bookmaker who's willing to advise them, an older bookmaker in the main ring, go round before racing, talk them through the day's racing, check they've got their computer working properly, check that they've got everything ready for their day's work, advise them on how big their liabilities should be, when they should be hedging, when they should be laying hedging business from other bookies or whatever. Because when you go into the ring and all you can see is old people, it doesn't bode well. We need to have a cross section. I like to work next to Julie Williams at Cheltenham. She's a real professional operator, and it can't have been easy following in her father's great footsteps. That's, you know, for a lady in the betting ring to bet under the name of Freddie Williams is that's daunting. And Julie is an excellent operator. I'd like to see more women betting in the ring. I'd like to see more minorities betting in the ring, but particularly I'd like to see more young people given chances as bookmakers.
So racecourses have obviously made an effort to get the young people in, but it seems to be backfiring because the focus is on either music or drinking. Do you think those could work in the long run, or would you have other ideas about how to attract the youth?
Yeah, but I think that are you talking about, I think really that's a question about society. If you say, well, hang on, all these people who we let into racecourses, they get pissed and fall over or have a punch up or whatever, that is, I don't think you're really moaning about the people that come to the races. You might be moaning about people in England. I think that, look, it's very easy to say, oh, as a purist, for people who do love the game, owners and whatever, members, look, we don't want lagerlouts at the races ruining it for us. But I think there is a happy medium. I think that if they pay the bills for us to enjoy a day at the races, sorry, but that's what we've got to do. But then there should be owners' bars and owners' areas provided for the purists to go to, where they can be together and not have someone, having a brawl next to them. It's about the bottom line, and that must be, we must keep an eye on that all the time.
And we can tell by the passionate way you've spoken that you absolutely love being a bookmaker in the position that you're in now, were there any people that sort of gave you a leg up along the way?
I feel so grateful to the game. It's given me so much, given me so many good friends, so many people that I've done other business with, so many happy memories. And I think there is look, it can be very, very ruthless, the game. It can be vicious. But there is also a lot of kindness in the game. And when I think back to when I was a teenager, the likes of the Brown family, West End Racing, Bo Brown, his brother Matt, who sadly died when he was 40, a very, very nice man, Matt Brown. He used to give me work experience, always used to check on me, or used to ring me, "You all right, Ben, what's happening?" His dad, Ray, when I was a bookie at Oxford, when I was 20, I had the worst pitch at the end. I used to bet under the name Wharton Slaney. Remember the old boy who I said I used his pitches? And Ray, whenever I used to run out of money, he'd lend me a grand. Lofty, Martin Chapman, he taught me a lot when I was a child. I used to go to Hove Dogs, used to watch out for me, used to be patient, you know, teaching me how to clerk, teaching me the fractions. Neil Channing, when I used to do my work experience at City Index as a teenager, I used to write to him from school with questions about betting and bookmaking, things I didn't understand. And then when I'd go there in the holidays, I'd sit next to him, he'd explain how he'd change the prices from fixed odds into spread prices, and we'd break it down mathematically to 100%, then make the spread prices. Then he with Steve Todd, his business partner at the races, they used to give me work experience and I could lay the odd horse. They were very kind to me, took me to Cheltenham. Kelvin Richardson for introducing me to Tony Bloom, who gave me a job in Gibraltar. Tony himself for teaching me a lot about value, a man who has a wonderful appreciation of value. Martin Johnston, class act, great operator, real professional gambler, a Rolls Royce of a bookmaker, a gentleman. He taught me a lot. Tony Morris, I used to go and watch him work. And then when I became a bookmaker myself, I wrote to him. And then he met me and he became a mentor. Tony Morris was an immaculate man. He was a very, very professional operator. He was a man who understood and loved self-control and control of the betting ring that he worked in. And he gave good advice, but he was very hard, taskmaster. And he pulled no punches. But when I look back, everything he said to me, however harsh it may have been, was true. And I carry with me Tony Morris's advice every day. And I will never forget the dinners I used to have with him when I was having bad times. And I was thinking, oh my God, how am I going to keep going here? Sometimes just to call Tony Morris, he was a figure of strength, like a pillar of a strength of character, a man of real strength of character, extreme strength of character. And just to hear his voice made me feel strong and would power me on for the rest of the week. Come on, you've got to keep going, you've got to do this, make this business work, beat these punters. It's very sad when he died, but I bought the flat that he grew up in from his wife, Maria. And I feel very, very grateful to Gary Woodgate, the star managing director, a gentleman, someone who's grown with me, and he's helped me grow. I've been very proud to see him grow as an operator. I could not have asked for more in a right-hand man and a managing director. I really could not have done. Fiercely loyal, shrewd, someone who's pushed me on when I've needed confidence, someone who's held me back when he's felt there's a fall on the way. You know, I have a great management team now, Russ Candler, Trevor, our head of trading, excellent operators, Luke Tarr. There cannot be someone who puts more into Cheltenham and Ascot than Luke, a real trier there. And we're going to be going online soon. Jane Leggett's worked very, very hard, tirelessly, to try and design this online platform. But the team as a whole, we have a great team that on the big days at Cheltenham and Royal Ascot, when we work together, we can, don't worry about Bet365, Paddy Power, all those people. At Cheltenham and Royal Ascot, Star Sports have a lot going on, and we work we fulfil our potential at Cheltenham and Royal Ascot, and I'm very, very proud of the team, and I'm very, very grateful to the game.
One of your most high profile places to bet is the Cheltenham Festival. You made the front page of the broadsheets last year. How do you feel about being a bookmaker in such an environment at such an event?
2 weeks before Cheltenham and Royal Ascot, each day I feel more and more pressure, and it gets to say the Thursday or Friday before Cheltenham or Ascot, and I am very, very highly strung. I'm probably not a nice person to come near because I feel really on edge. And I like to know when I'm betting at the races on the big days, I'm going to get there. My account forms are ready. The cards I hand out to people are ready. The sweets, we give all the punters a sweet, they're ready. I want the board to look clean. When I get there, I want to see the first races up already. I want to see that the board has had a respray and been tarted up before the big meetings. I want to see that the staff at Royal Ascot are in top hat and tails, or at Cheltenham they've got the Star Sports jacket on, they're wearing a tie, and they're representing the company to the best of our ability. And I notice every little detail. Then I go up to the box. We always try and have some, someone interesting there, whether it be Big Mac or a jockey or whoever, to entertain the clients. I'd like to see that they're there, they're ready to have a chat with everybody. We've got someone doing a preview, he's going to be on time. And I like to know that everything's running smoothly, and I feel very, very tense. And then I go down for the first race, and as soon as I start betting away, it's a little bit of a relief. It's a bit of a relief. I'm tense because I'm waiting for the first liability. Always a big liability on the first race at Cheltenham and the first race at Royal Ascot on the Tuesday. Always. And as soon as the tape goes up at Cheltenham or they come out the starting stalls at Royal Ascot, it's like a real weight off my shoulders. And then I'm just working away, and I'm not really thinking about the results. I'm just trying to take Tony Morris. One of his lessons was take as much money as possible at the lowest possible price. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to serve every punter, whether they be a fiver punter or someone having 10 grand on. I'm trying to know what's happening in the office with the big punters, know what's happening with any punting that we're doing, and just be in the groove. And really then, it's a bit like when you see people on their wedding day and they're very nervous, you say, look, it's too late to change anything now, everything will be fine. And I just want to be part of the experience, but I like to get that first race going.
And you mentioned Royal Ascot and Cheltenham. How do the two compare as a bookmaker?
Well, look, we've got top pitches at Cheltenham. We bet three in Tats, which has got better every year. Tats, that really, people say bad things about Tats at Cheltenham. I don't know why. I think it's a great place to bet. And we bet on the rails, down on the bottom rail. That would be the more valuable pitch. You wouldn't take as much there, but you take it well. They lay a lot of horses down there. Cheltenham is about big liabilities. Cheltenham is about, it is a rougher ride. At Royal Ascot, we have a pitch on the rails where we bet round the back, we bet well, we lay a lot of runners, we bet to good figures, very expensive pitch. We also bet in Tats, pick 19. It is, you know, I think we paid about 30 grand for the pitch. It's been the best pitch we've ever bought. I've bet two in the front line. I couldn't believe it. I've bet three in the front line several times, but nine times out of 10, we bet two on the second. It's a great place for taking money. You're in a great position there. And at Royal Ascot, I would say to anybody, you will get, as a bookmaker, value for money there. There are so many great places to bet. You can bet on the front line, or me, I bet on the second near the rail. I take lots of money there. The big punters come to me there. You can bet down the other end on one of the ends. You can bet on the grass. You can bet round the back, but by the parade ring. There's so many great places to bet at Royal Ascot. You bet to better figures than Cheltenham. You lay more runners. You don't take as much, but on the whole, I don't, you know, the credit office and on course, we wouldn't take as much at Royal Ascot, but I would rather be a layer at Royal Ascot.
And Glorious Goodwood, not quite so glorious?
Well, Bill Tye, who's a nice guy, he worked for Victor Chandler for many years. When we bought their pitches, I had a chat with him and he said, oh, so are you going to keep Badwood? And I said, what's Badwood? He said, oh, well, I always used to call Goodwood Badwood because we never used to win there. And I thought, oh, well, maybe they were unlucky there or something like that. And we've bet at Goodwood, I don't know how long we've bet there. Let's say we've bet there 6 years. I tell you what, we must have lost five. It is so hard. I don't know what it is. We've got a great pitch on the rails. We've got a great pitch on Tats. The rails gets busier and busier at Goodwood. Tats is not what I'd like it to be. We never win there. We never win. We always win at Aintree. We always win at Epsom. We don't always win at Cheltenham. Cheltenham's a big swing. Ascot, we generally win. Goodwood, I don't know what happens there. I love going there for the week. I look forward to it. It's like going on holiday for a week. Always doing my bollocks. Always.
You mentioned Aintree. That's another sort of special occasion, the Grand National, the bet out.
The nicest clients that we do business with all year are the Liverpool clients. They are such, I always look forward to my few days a year up at Liverpool. We have a night out. We only have the one pitch there. We go out every night. We try somewhere new. We've been into the city. I have a run in the morning. Either we once stayed out by the beach somewhere, great place. I was running on these sand dunes and through pine forests, and then another year we stayed in the town. I was running along the river and through the town. Really nice people, lovely people to serve, and I don't know why, but we always seem to win there. I've probably put the bock on it, but it's a good place to bet.
And the final jewel in your crown, Epsom.
We bet on the rails at Epsom, and I think that Epsom will be the prime example that everybody talks about. Where's a good place to bet? Where's a good place to open a betting shop? Where's a good place to be a punter? Where's a good place to bet as a bookmaker? And things spring to my mind. When I was a bookie at Walthamstow, sometimes I'd go and see an exhibition beforehand. I'd go to a museum or something like that. Anyway, I went to see Leonardo da Vinci exhibition once at the V&A in Knightsbridge. And I went in, and around the ceiling, they had his favourite quotes, and in glass cases around the room, they had all of the amazing paintings. He painted bridges, he designed, and engineering things and all the rest of it. One of his quotes was, "I believe what my eyes tell me." Now, I only believe what my eyes tell me. A different individual has had a different career, but is very, very clever, is the well-known punter and, shall we say, rogue, scallywag, be the kind of word, Barry Conway. And then Barry used to say to me at Walthamstow, I used to say to Barry, where can I get on? Where can I go and get back shows? Or where can I go and do this? Where can I do that? He'd say, Ben, anything I tell you is old news. He said, if somebody says to me, oh, you can get good prices in this shop, or you can get back shows in this shop, or whatever, he says, by the time I get there, the coup's ended. He says, I like to go to places on my own and see what's happening there then. And Epsom, for me, is a prime example of that. Everybody, whenever you speak to anyone, you say, oh, what do you think of Epsom? They go, oh, it's quite good in tax. The rails are absolutely useless. Rubbish. We take fantastic money on the rails at Epsom. Lots of good sort of £200, £300, £500 punters. 2 days, or it's only 2 days, so what? Oaks Day, you take great money, you still take quite good money on Derby Day, you take a bit less because it's top hat and tails in the members' enclosure there. But we take great money at Epsom, we seem to win there, and from what I'm told, you can buy a pitch very cheaply on the rails there. So I'd recommend anybody to buy a pitch there.
And finally, of course, Toaster. How was that on the Grand Derby?
I always used to say that my favourite day of the year was the Brighton Marathon, when I used to run the Brighton Marathon. The best night of my life was sponsoring the Greyhound Derby, the Greyhound Derby final. I loved betting there with Lofty. I loved having the whole team there, seeing Gary Woodgate, who's been such a wonderful right-hand man, managing director, confidant, best friend. To see his face looking at the track, he just looked stunned to see that we were sponsoring the Greyhound Derby. And you believe me, you know, we've bet front row at Royal Ascot, we've bet on the Tuesday at Cheltenham in Tats when it's been fierce, you know, that year when the Mullins horses were all winning and the firms jumped into action and were all playing. Nothing gets near Greyhound Derby final night. That was electric. We took massive money, massive, massive money. Average cash bet, £84. Endless monkey and grand punters, £2,000 this. We had, you know, punters were falling out of the sky. It was a fabulous, fabulous night to work. And I look forward, please God, to another really, really busy and even busier Greyhound Derby final night this coming summer.
And finally, any sporting event in the entire world, if you could make a book there that you don't already make a book out, where would it be?
Well, we've done the darts, we've done the snooker, we've got a betting shop at Lord's for the cricket, we've done the oval, we've done show jumping with our friend Stephen Wunke up at Chester. Where would I don't know, the World Cup final. Give me a betting shop inside the ground at the World Cup final.
New Betting People interviews are published every week at Star Sports. Exclusive interviews with the key people from the world of sports betting. Check out our full library of interviews at starsportsbet.co.uk, begambleaware.org. Over 18 only.